an interview with Paul DeMaas, one of the architects of the Stony Brook campus, at his home in Springs on Long Island, September 19th. I regard myself as simply the collector of basic information.
Sure.
While people are still living who know about the creation and the early development. And I'm going back up to Albany Monday, and I will see Herb Gordon, who is in the central office in charge of land acquisition to begin with. I will see Steve again. I will see James Warren, who was the vice chairman of the Board of Trustees under Frank Moore. And Norman Hurd wanted me to see Axelrod and Gillette in the Bureau of the Budget. Now, there may be others that I ought to see up there. If you have any ideas, I wish you would.
Frank Matzke.
Frank Matzke.
Is he on your list?
No, he's not.
He's very important.
I see.
He was the right arm of Tony Adenofi.
The right-hand man of the...
Yeah,
I see.
He was the second commander.
I see.
And he, I don't know where he is now. I think it, the last I heard of him, he was, I think, in the Rensselaer. I'm not sure, but they will tell you where he is.
M-A-D-S-K-Y?
M-A-T.
M-A-T.
Matzke, what do you mean? M-A-T-S-K-E.
S-K-E, I see.
K-E. You like it strong, though?
Thank you very much.
Is it still on?
Is it?
Yes, it's on. Maybe it's
too strong. No, it's too strong.
First, tell me about your appointment and your early connection. How did you happen to become connected with the university project? You were with your own firm?
Yes. At that time, I had my own firm. I was working with a friend of mine, Burke Weigel, and we both were old friends of George Dudley.
I see.
From UN times.
From United Nations times.
We all worked
on the United Nations
on
building.
The United Nations building. That's how I came to this country.
Is that right?
To work on the UN. I came here to join Le Corbusier to work on the UN building.
Le Corbusier. From where? Where'd you come?
From France.
France.
I was in Paris.
I see.
And then Le Corbusier went right after I came in, but I continued to work with Harris on the UN building. I was part of the design team of the UN building. Mm-hmm. At that time, Burke Weigel was also involved in the production part of the drawings, and George Dudley had been involved before my time with Harrison and with Le Corbusier himself and with the other team of the international team of architects. So we all knew each other from that time. We had kept friendly relations.
Sure.
And when George became one of the trustees, George was a good friend of Nelson Rockefeller.
Yes.
When he became one of the trustees, of course, the entire process
trustees
of building
of the construction fund.
Construction fund.
Yes.
Before that, the early campus buildings were built under the old system by the Department of Public Works.
Yes.
But of course, with expansion, tremendous expansion that Nelson Rockefeller was planning, the public works department was not equipped to handle it.
Right.
So that's why the construction fund was established. And Dudley became one of the three first trustees.
Who were the other two, do you know?
I used to know, but I can find it, but I don't. I can find it somewhere. So at that time, they realized that what had been built on the campus was really below standards as far as design is concerned. And they changed entirely the process.
Now this, what date was this approximately?
Oh, this was when they came in, when the fund was established legally. I don't know, but I'm sure you have that in your
phone. Yes.
When I came in was 1964.
Right.
When Joe...
I think the fund was established in 62. I think it had just been established.
Yeah, it took them a little time to get organized. And then they let go the old architects working on the campus. And they started hiring new teams of more, let's say, young and more contemporary inclined designers.
Right.
And so at that time, George called me, called also Burke Wagner, with whom I was already working. And at the same time, there was another friend of his who had not worked on the UN building, but it was Jan Pokorny.
Pokorny, yes.
So he had the idea to give us one of the buildings, mm-hmm. which was the student union.
I see.
That was our first project.
I see.
So we created a joint venture. Burke Wagner and I became associates full-time. And we made a joint venture with Jan Pokorny's office. And that's why the student union mm-hmm. was built.
Right.
That was 64, 65, while we were working on the drawings. Now, how the architects, how the architects were selected, because after all, why would they pick up us when...
I want to do that, but let me ask you one question about the student union. Would it be possible, in view of the size of the university now, to add a structure above the student union? In other words, add several floors above it.
Are you talking about the central the garden, the court, or the building itself?
The building itself. Get more space, in other words.
Yes, I know you are very tight there. Possibly we have to check foundations. That would be the main thing to check. We have our engineers at that time, we could get them in. Check the foundation. If the foundations take, the column would take one or two floors without problems. Could be done.
Right.
If it cannot be done, another way you can do it is to put foundations around the building, near the walls. Start from the ground, go up without touching the building. In other words, you can create a building over the existing building without even touching it.
I see.
By having columns on the periphery of the building and then other columns on the periphery of the building, but inside in the garden.
Yes.
And then span across with big beams. It's an expensive system, but it can be done.
Uh-huh.
That has been done many times.
Okay, go ahead.
What was I saying? I was talking about the process of...
how architects...
Were chosen.
Were chosen, right.
Well, they were chosen basically by their reputation. There were no competitions or anything like that. It was basic because they had a certain name already in the profession. They had things published before and they were known. And all the architects that got called there were fairly well-known architects.
And who did the calling? Was it the construction fund itself? Or was Steve involved?
Then, of course, there we got into a touchy affair here. Basically, at the beginning, it was Dudley who was the architect among the trustees, mm-hmm. who was the force behind it.
Yes, sir.
And then Tony Adinolfi came in. Tony Adinolfi was brought in, I believe, by George also. He was working in Detroit.
In Detroit?
In the school system in Detroit, I think.
I see.
He was in charge of building the schools for Detroit. So we had that experience of construction administration. And so Tony Adinolfi became director of the fund, director of the fund. And then he took over with the advice of Dudley, of course, because they were very good friends. He took over, and all the work done at the fund was done under the direction of Tony Adinolfi. He was the power.
I see.
And under him was the man I just mentioned, was Frank Metzkin.
Frank Metzkin.
Was his assistant.
I see.
And then there were a bunch of other, of course, engineers. And Frank is very important in your study because he was in charge of several campuses.
And you think he's still in the Albany area?
No, I have lost track of him, frankly. He's not an old man, so he's...
I see.
You can find it.
All right. I'll do that.
So Tony Adinolfi was an excellent man. He was very good, very friendly, and knew how to deal with architects. He was very good. Mm-hmm. And all the projects, of course, were approved by the fund. Everything we did, we had meetings, constant meetings in Albany. We had to drive back and forth to Albany. Mm-hmm. And at every phase of our drawings, we made a presentation. Everybody was there from the fund, from the university.
Who from the university at the time?
Ed Stevens.
Stevens was anybody there from the local campus, from Stony Brook?
No, let me think. Sometimes there was a man, forget his name now, he was not campus architect, but Red Autumn, but he was in charge of, he was part of the staff of Stony Brook, and he was in charge of supervising construction in some way. His name will come back to me.
Begins with C, was it Camp? Never mind, I forgot
it too.
Okay. Right.
Sometimes he was there, but as an observer, because he had nothing, nothing to say. He did put some input when the programs were established for the buildings. So in other words, before an architect starts a project, he receives what we call a program, which has all the requirements established by the university, both by the university and also with input from the campus. And that program has list all the rooms you need, how large the rooms are, the function of the rooms, how many persons will be on those rooms, etc., etc. Has the entire requirements for the architect to follow.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think that's fine.
So, you were there also, but basically from the university was Edwin Stevens. Mm-hmm. Now, Ed Stevens, of course, represents the entire university, so he had the power, of course, to comment on our projects. Mm-hmm. He did not have, I don't think he had the power of veto, mm-hmm. but of course he had an important power because he represented the university. But ultimately, Adinolfi was the one who said yes or no and how. You are the power. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if this is for the record.
This is not going to go anywhere outside the archives and be seen by, be listened to by the person who will be doing the history.
Mm. Well, we have to skip this part then. That's the way.
I can turn it off.
Yeah, turn it off.
All right. All right. Just a minute. All right. Now we were talking about the selection of the architects, and initially, you were given one building.
Yes.
But then...
Well, I gave the student union, and Tony Offer was impressed enough with our presentations, with our ideas. So one day he called us up, he said, look, you guys are doing a very good job. How would you like to take over the entire campus planning? So, of course, we have to do it. That's a tremendous responsibility.
Mm-hmm. When was this? Do you have any idea?
Well, that was, what I mean, probably 65, I believe. Probably one year later.
Was John Toll president then? Or had he just come on? He came September of 65.
It was before, no, I think it was before Toll. That we got engaged as campus planners.
I see.
And at that time I was the planner, because I'm a graduate planner, so I took in charge personally all planning matters
on
that campus. So we revised, there was a preliminary campus plan done by the former architect. But of course we revised everything. We made a complete new campus plan. Not only the plan, but the time schedule for various buildings coming up.
Right.
And most important of all, we did, at the request of Adinolfi, we did what we call a design vocabulary.
I remember.
You may
that.
Have seen that.
I remember
you
that.
You remember that, which is a little book, you know. It's
yes.
Which I did personally with my employees, because I was in charge of the campus. And that's how the new aspect of the campus came in, the new design approach, the new brick, the new pavings, you know, everything was.
I remember one day there were two piles of brick out on the main campus outside the library, and John and I looked at them, and John said, which of the two colors do you like? And I made a choice. Now I don't remember which one it was, but I think we agreed on the color of brick. And that's the one that has been used.
Yeah. Yeah, we made quite a bit of research on some good brick. In fact, we made a mistake. We picked up a very good, too good and expensive brick.
We did.
And so that brick had to be used by all the other architects that came in on the campus. And some buildings did not use it for budget reasons. The dormitories, for instance, and the Gruzin dormitories, they used in brown brick, but not as good as brick, because it was much less expensive brick.
Uh-huh.
The pavers, is this kind of pavers you have there, not this side, but the same kind of pavers you have there.
Let me ask you this. The campus design that you found was a central core of major buildings, but fingers going out like spokes.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
With the science area, engineering area, and arts and sciences area not as clearly, precisely marked. When I came in 62, I found the library building being built, and right next to it, the chemistry building.
Yeah.
And right across from it, a biology building. Mm-hmm. And way over here, a humanities building.
Right, well, we are.
And I wondered who had done that planning, because the disciplines that use the library most are those in the social sciences and the humanities. not the sciences.
Right.
And they put the chemistry building so close that they couldn't...
Yeah, very close. That we find a lot of things which, you know, we try to remediate, to try to change, but sometimes we could not because the buildings were there.
Yes.
What could we do?
Yeah.
But the system of the fingers, really we developed that system. It's not our invention, it's and we tried all our designs for campus planning were based on the finger system. In fact, was the first, at first the campus was planned for, I believe it was for 25,000 students.
Originally, 3,000, the earliest plan
was
a small college.
Oh yeah, of course, at that time. But then
they had large ideas, yes.
Well, it went all the way to 25,000 students. So those fingers really would extend way out, the fingers of the humanities would extend way out, it was not built. Then, of course, they realized that they had seen too far and too big. There were not enough students to for that. So practically nothing was built, not entirely as we had planned. But the finger system was the basic conception of the campus. Of course, we had, sometimes we couldn't do much about the buildings which were there except growing ivy on the walls.
That's right.
Which, in fact, I remember the first report I did to at the north after I saw the campus. Was a report, I don't have it anymore, but it was a report written among the main items was recommendations to grow ivy immediately because it's very slow to grow if you want to hide this brick, this red wall brick. The library, since you mentioned the library, as you remember, was a small library in the red brick.
About 100,000 square feet.
Yes, and it was, you know, built so-called in the federal style, I don't know what that means, but, so to hide that, as you know, we build all around the library.
Yes, I know you do.
The library, it's swallowed by the new building.
Right.
Which I think was a very successful project, I think it works well.
Yes. You were in charge by that time of the design of the library.
Now that came later. First we had the student union. Then we were given, I think first came the administration building.
Yes, I think so.
I think came first. And then it came the library. Then the Fine Arts Center.
Yes.
We were also in charge, as part of the planning system, we were also in charge of a very good, very difficult, I would say, thing, a problem, was to coordinate all the other architects.
Yes.
At some point there were, you know, five or six architects, and how many engineers working on various parts of the campus. Somebody had to coordinate these people.
Yeah.
And that was my own job. It was a very difficult job I had to do that.
I would think so.
Because some of the architects there were older than I and better known than I. Like Breuer came in, he didn't stay.
Yes.
Because he realized that he had to submit his plans to the overall concept.
Yes.
And I was in charge to make sure that all these architects working on the campus would follow the design vocabulary to create some kind of unity in the campus. That sometimes very difficult and diplomatic task I had yet to do.
Yes.
So that's the last building, we were the Fine Arts building and the campus center, the plaza.
It took us quite a while to get approval for the Fine Arts Building. We had our plans much earlier, even before Sam Gould came in.
Oh yes, I remember. That's one of the oldest projects on the campus.
Yes.
Took a long time to start, and then we had a problem with that building too, because we made two projects for the building, I don't know if you remember that. We made two projects. The first project was a much smaller scale, a much smaller building. And it came out at the time, I forget now, 71, 72, I forget the date. At that time, you could not get any contractors, because there's a building boom in Long Island. Mm-hmm. You could not get anybody to bid. And there were two bidders, only two bidders, willing to bid on this, the finance building, the first project. And one of them didn't want the building. He gave such a high price that obviously did not want it, didn't even figure. So we got down to one single bidder, who came also a very high price, very high bid, above the budget. So, but Tony Adelofing was a very reasonable man. He realized that it was a special condition. It was not at all our fault. Mm-hmm. So legally, he could have told us, redesign it without fee. But he realized that we had nothing to do with us, it had to do with the conditions at that time. In the meantime, the college had decided they wanted a larger, much larger facility. So they redrafted the requirements, the program, from a, I forget the square footage of the building, but what you have there now is 3 or 4 times what in the initial program.
Is that right?
Oh, yeah.
Well, they, right now, they wish that the main stage, main auditorium, were a little larger. It seats 1,100.
1,200.
No?
Don't think so.
Well,
my collection 1,200, I can look at.
Yeah. But at any rate, they wish they'd had something like 1,500 at least. They just barely get a full-size orchestra on the stage.
That's always the afterthought, you know, that when we build, there are always the budget. The budget is the problem. So they have to reduce their program, their requirements accordingly.
Right.
And we know that, everybody knows that later on, we always regret not to have built. Right. But I think that's a normal situation.
Tell me about the Earth and Space Science Building and the lecture hall. The early buildings handled the elements of classrooms, offices, laboratories in different ways. The humanities building, the classrooms are in the middle and the offices at either end like an H. The building is in the form of an H. The chemistry and physics buildings and the classrooms are on one side and the offices and laboratories on the other side of the corridor. And in each case, these early red brick buildings, there is a 125-seat auditorium at the end. And then comes the lecture hall, nothing but classrooms. And architects, there was no uniformity in that respect. Whether good or bad is a question. But they used different formulae.
Yeah, I don't think you know, when you design a building, I don't think you can follow a particular strict formula,
right,
to where to put the faculty offices and where to locate the classrooms. Mm-hmm. Depends, a great deal depends, in this case particularly, depends on the location of the building within the master plan.
I see.
Because the master plan established the location, and in the great, they also established, in a way, the form of the building. For instance, the lecture hall. The master plan called for a lecture hall in the center of a square plaza,
right,
surrounding the lecture hall. So the lecture hall was a building by itself, like a sculpture,
yes,
within,
yes,
the center of the plaza, if you like.
Mm-hmm. Right.
The earth and space science building was a location such that it called for an L-shaped building.
Yes.
So within that L, you can say, well, you can put all the faculty rooms on one side, all the classrooms on the other L, part of the L, but there is no reason to do it. It's
right.
A matter of function, practicality. There is no law which says they should be all together, mm-hmm, or they should be facing each other. No.
No. No. That's right. She's interested. You're a good dog. Good doggy. I think